Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the long-term effects of bullying on victims, the bullies themselves, and society at large. But first, the world has lost another strong voice for ethical journalism. Last week, Danny Schechter, often called the News Dissector, lost his battle to pancreatic cancer. Danny Schechter was an award-winning broadcaster, documentarian, and author. He has produced a long list of important work with wide-ranging topics from apartheid to economic scandals. In honor of Danny Schechter's life, we are re-airing an interview that we did with him here on the Scholar Circle in 2010 about the financial crisis.
The Afghanistan war horrors have been exposed worldwide through WikiLeaks. The Gulf disaster continues choking off marine life, and the economy is still pummeling working people into desperate situations. The realities are pretty stark. And our next guest has been examining how the media have played into these disasters. Would they have gotten this far if the media had been more on the ball? We have with us Danny Schechter. He's a journalist, author, and filmmaker. He's the executive producer of Global Vision, a New York-based television and film production company, and he founded and executive produced several series, including South Africa Now, Rights and Wrongs, Human Rights Television, many documentaries, including the latest, which is called Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and several books, Embedded, Weapons of Mass Deception, Media Wars, The More You Watch, The Less You Know, and The Death of Media and the Fight to Save Democracy. His latest is also called Plunder. Welcome, Danny Schechter.
Well, thank you for joining us. That's a great sum up of the whole program right there. I'm pleased to be here. The issues you're raising about media, of course, are issues that have preoccupied me for many, many years because I, you know, came out of mainstream media to some degree. I worked in commercial radio. I worked at ABC News. I worked at CNN. I did a stint at CNBC. So I've been on the inside. A lot of my writing about the media has been informed by that experience. So it's not just kind of a content analysis in some dry academic way, but it's what I've actually seen and the battles that I've been in to try to get certain stories on the air. Sometimes I've won, sometimes I've lost, but also to get the feeling of what a media culture is and why it seems to be stripped of much intellectual curiosity, much less any sense of mission to really get at the truth about some of these deeper crises. And that's something that I was concerned about during the war. I did the film Weapons of Mass Deception, showing how the media function. And now I've been working since about 2005 on this financial crisis with an eye on not only reporting what's not being reported, but also questioning why the media has not raised these questions because, you know, we're in a situation with this most severe economic crisis since the Great Depression. Some think it's worse than the Great Depression. And, you know, most of our media didn't warn us about it, didn't really look into it, didn't, you know, make connection or connect the dots, so to speak. And this is true to the present day. It's been some improvement after the financial meltdown. But in the lead up to the meltdown, you know, with the housing bubble that was started under President Bush, really, in 2001, there was virtually no coverage of any of this. And partly that's because in that same period, there was a tremendous increase in advertising in all forms of media, radio, television, and on the internet by lenders, credit card companies, and the like. So sort of not a surprise that they don't look too deeply into the industry that's paying their bills.
Now, you indicate in Plunder that the European media handles this a little bit better. Could you elaborate on that?
There's a tradition in Europe of more diversity in the media. So you have kind of left-wing or press that's far more progressive, The Guardian in England, Le Monde in France, other newspapers and outlets that do more in-depth documentaries. And so the media culture there is more open to a culture of, you know, questioning and of criticism to some degree. A lot of that has changed. I wouldn't say it's free of contradictions and it's a, you know, total alternative to what we have because it's been sort of watered down. Also, the market logic of the so-called free market has invaded many of these cultures so that the organizations like the BBC are working with fewer resources or don't have the same mission, if you will, that they may have had at one time. So, but you do find in Europe more questioning, more coverage that's critical, But I would say the media worldwide failed us here. I mean, a lot of the press, for example, the Telegraph in London has done a good job of, you know, questioning all of this and predicting, you know, a lot of crises. The Economist magazine in England also is much more focused. The Financial Times has covered a lot of stories that the Wall Street Journal hasn't. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal today is under the control of Rupert Murdoch, so perhaps it's less willing to do the kind of investigative reporting that it once did. So you see across the spectrum a lack of focus on these issues. And part of the reason for it is, you know, us also. Talking about money makes people nervous. They don't understand it often. There's a very low level of media literacy in our country. And as a result, a lot of people don't want to talk about it. When I made my film, In Debt We Trust, I found progressive movements sort of in denial about all of this. You know, Danny, how come you're saying it's so bad? Hasn't your apartment gone up in value? So this is what we're dealing with, is that people would much rather get into partisan political debates, you know, and if you're on the left, bash the right. If you're on the right, bash the left. But not look at the structural nature of the crisis that we're in. Not look at the systemic problems, you know, the banking system and all the rest of it. So it's a harder effort to get these issues into people's minds and to get them to talk about them. And unfortunately, you know, I found this to be as true of people on the left as many people on the right. Although what I found with my film, Plunder the Crime of Our Time, is that a lot of conservative media are very open to talking about it and positive about it, you know, and I have been getting on the air in all the Pacifica stations and whatnot, and there have been a lot of supportive people there as well. But, you know, it's for some reason this notion of fighting for economic justice or being concerned about economic justice seems to have receded in importance, whereas at one time it was the central dynamic in the fight for progressive change.
When was that?
Well, the 30s come to mind, don't they? The 40s, the organizing drives of the unions and what have you. But, you know, the unions became sort of, I wouldn't say fat exactly, but they lost a lot of their social mission, too. And left movements began, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movements that the unions really weren't as connected to as they should have been. So, you know, you have this disconnect, if you will, about those who are fighting for the needs of working people, in terms of not only wages and but housing and just overall conditions for people, education and for health care and all the rest of it. These issues haven't sort of been as sexy, let's say, as bashing Bush was, marching on the White House against the war. There weren't many people linking that to deeper problems in our culture.
You actually posed a rhetorical question about at the end of Bush, we were expecting a new world order. And should today we also expect a new media order? What would that look like?
Well, you know, in a curious way, no system is static. All systems are changing. The media is going through a profound crisis. The major brands, the major media outlets have lost their business model and their dominance. The internet has emerged with all of its many contradictions and millions of websites as a basically more stimulating, more interactive, more democratic means of communication in some ways. And then, you know, just this past week, the WikiLeaks example of a website, a small group of people who were determined to get out the truth about what's happening in Afghanistan, were able to get access to thousands, tens of thousands of documents and make them public. And, you know, in some ways you saw that major newspapers like the New York Times, the Guardian, the Spiegel in Germany were willing to publish what they had. That wouldn't have happened necessarily in the past. Because don't forget, Daniel Ellsberg had been inside the RAND Corporation there in Santa Monica. He had been inside the Pentagon. He had been military officer in Vietnam. So he was coming out of the system in a way. Here are people who are really like WikiLeaks, who are against the system, and yet they have become a force that is really dominating the discussion of Afghanistan because of what they've done. So the media is not the same as it once was. It is changing. At the same time, there are certain patterns where it's very hard for dissenting ideas to get heard, to get listened to be debated. I mean, I'm having a really frustrating time getting on the air. I've been on KPFK a few few times. I've been on the other Pacifica stations. I get on Press TV out of Iran. I get on Al Jazeera. But I'm not getting on MSNBC. I'm not getting on the stations I used to work for, even. Okay, maybe they know me too well. I don't know.
Speaking of WikiLeaks, we should talk just a bit about that. Robert Scheer called it brilliant journalism. But mainstream media really have treated a little bit, especially today, if you look at it, they call it a yawner.
Right, a ho-hummer. You know, I have a blog up now on mediachannel.org, basically called The United States of Wiki Denial. You know, basically talk about how in the United States, on many of the dominant channels, there was an effort to basically characterize all this nothing new here, what's the big deal, this sort of thing. And to shift the focus on, are our troops being put at greater danger because of these disclosures? WikiLeaks is a menace. The Republicans want to see the people from WikiLeaks prosecuted under the Espionage Act. So the whole issue is no longer on Afghanistan, what's happening there. And even on Afghanistan,
it's on the
WikiLeaks
leak now.
Did this to try to draw attention to the civilian casualties which are in Afghanistan, which are growing, okay, and make that their concern. But the American media coverage of it, the New York Times, that was not their principal focus. They were more interested in the politics of Pakistan, heat-seeking missiles, you know, the Karzai government, whereas the Guardian and the Spiegel in Europe were much more concerned about what's happening to civilians and the devastating impact of the war on ordinary people. So this is a cultural phenomenon, but it's also a phenomenon of political control. And now there's a sort of backlash going on to discredit WikiLeaks. You know, Time magazine has a big cover about torture by the Taliban, all this kind of propaganda to try to, which has some truth to it, you know, but to try to basically put the public back in a supportive role towards the war in Afghanistan. And what we're seeing is an elite defection, 100 Democrats, 12 Republicans voting against the supplemental. I mean, this is almost unprecedented. It shows the fact that the war is not popular, the war is not supported by most of the people. And so the administration has a problem. And then along comes WikiLeaks, and the problem kind of is magnified.
If you, after all these years of being in media, being inside mainstream media, being outside mainstream media, we're going to say, you know, we know the public needs to have a particular amount of information in order for a democratic society to work. And we know that government should have a certain amount of transparency. How would you go from here?
Well, I mean, I can just tell you what I'm trying to do. What I'm doing is I'm writing commentaries, Huffington Post and Op-Ed News and Global Research and MediaChannel.org, which we went for 11 years. It's now, you know, it's harder to get funding now, to get support for all of these ventures have been cut back. That's why all of the websites you keep reading all these desperate appeals for money. And so there's more of that. But I'm also making a film, and, you know, even though it's a low-budget film, I'm trying to get it out. I'm trying to get screenings. There have been a few in L.A. You can find out more about it at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com, which is our website that has a lot of information on how you can order the film and more information not only about the film, but my book, which is a companion book called The Crime of Our Time, which I believe you had a chance to have a look at, which is filled with, you know, analysis and kind of a much more detailed argument than you can put into a documentary.
Well, Danny Schechter, thank you so much for being with us. Again, the film is called Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, and the book is called The Crime of Our Time, and The Wall Street is Not Too Big to Jail. And our guest is Danny Schechter. Thank you again.
The News Dissector.
The News Dissector. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was an interview with Danny Schechter from 2010 that we have re-aired to remember some of his contributions to our public knowledge. Danny Schechter died last week of pancreatic cancer.
When we come back, how do you heal the children abducted and forced into child soldiering or sex slavery? Up next, stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. What becomes of the children abducted and forced into sex slavery and child soldiering? Our next guest is helping them heal and rebuild their lives. Jane Akaya is a therapist and the founder of Children of Peace Uganda. Welcome, Jane Akaya. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Maria.
Most people know a little bit about what has been going on in Uganda with the Lord's Resistance Army, but they don't know the scope of it and the details of it. Can you give us a sense of how dire the situation was and what it's like today?
The LRA rebellion led by one Joseph Kony started way back in 1988. And I think he felt just dissatisfied with maybe what the government of Uganda was doing. And then he started this rebellion. He felt maybe the leadership should have been based on religious beliefs. And yet Uganda has so many other religions. So for him, he felt that's what he wanted. And yet the reality on the ground is that what he was doing and what he's doing right now does not relate to any religious principles at all. So it started just as a small movement and then it grew so large. Initially, he would talk to people and people thought, oh, maybe he was a good person. Then eventually when he realized that people were not buying his ideas, were not buying his ideologies, he started abducting children. And he would maybe break into a school and abduct any number of children that he would find in that school, regardless of the age. He would break into people's houses, maybe the whole village in the night. And he takes little children, even as young as 5-year-olds. And he walks them into captivity, into the bushes of northern Uganda. The children really get so enslaved in captivity. The children are trained as child soldiers. The girls are given out as the sex slaves to the commanders. They are also trained as soldiers. The children are definitely forced to do unthinkable things that anyone cannot imagine. They have to walk lots and lots of distance without food, without water. And according to the children that we would receive, a child can go even for 3 days or 5 days without any food and any water. And yet they are carrying lots and lots of luggage. And definitely most of the children died on the way. That went on from 1998 up to around 2006. When eventually there was, people tried to negotiate. But even so, there were some peace negotiations that the government tried with the Lord's Resistance Army rebels, but they never really materialized. As a result, according to the World Bank report of 2007, the number of the children and the youth who were abducted in northern Uganda alone is put at 66,000 children.
How many have survived, do you think, of that?
Oh, the ones who have survived and have returned home could be maybe something like 20,000. Only. That's a very, very low number compared to the children that got abducted. I have personally worked with children who were forced to kill their parents before they were abducted. I've worked with children who are forced to kill their own siblings. I have worked with children who are, you know, some of the things is just difficult to mention in air. But unthinkable atrocities like forcing children even to eat human flesh. That's how terrible the LRA is. They do things that you cannot imagine another human being would do to another human being, leave alone a child.
Right now, with what you've described in your own website as a relative peace, mm-hmm. are children still at big risk of being abducted like this?
Oh, in northern Uganda right now, no. But even as we know, the LRA, after they tried peace talks, the Juba peace talks in 2007, and, of course, which flopped in 2008, 2009, because the LRA was not cooperating. That time, there was a truce that was given to the rebels to cross to Sudan for the peace talks. So the government of Uganda then with other friends helped to block the way. So they are not abducting children in northern Uganda right now. But the abductions are continuing in the DRC, in Congo, and then in the Central African Republic. And that's a great concern for us because we know how much the LRA created a lot of damage in our children in northern Uganda. And we feel the pain because we know what he did in northern Uganda is what is duplicating in the other parts of the countries, in the other countries. And that's so terrible.
So your organization is now working to help these children, and now some of them I'm sure are adults, mm-hmm. to heal their own trauma and to rebuild their lives. How many have you worked with so far? How difficult is this task?
I personally worked with the Rakel Rehabilitation Center, where over 3,000 children that we worked with in that center as they returned from the LRA captivity. What I personally do is I set up a nonprofit because when the center closed down, the Rakel Center, that was towards the end of 2006, I knew inside my heart that the work that we had done at the center was an emergency kind of response. We usually call it first aid. We had only given the children and the youth first aid. And, you know, an accident victim cannot recover from that. We knew these children could not recover from that. So I personally decided to follow up the children to the communities because we reunited them with their families and others with relatives, those especially
the ones who still had families.
Yeah. So what we are doing right now as Children of Peace Uganda is follow the children to the community, identify their different needs on an individual basis, and see how do we support them, how do we empower them to become self-reliant adults in the near future.
And what are some of the things that you're doing with them? I saw that some of the activities deal with using drama, using art. What is working, and what are the results that you're seeing?
We are using a holistic kind of approach because right now, besides the former child soldiers, we have children born in the LRA captivity to these young little mothers. And then we have children also who have lost parents to the LRA. So as Children of Peace Uganda, we've decided to bring all of them together because they are all directly affected. So what do we do with them? We do trauma therapy through creative art. We do drama with them. We do music. We do drawing. And in each activity, we attach a theme. In trauma therapy through art, we've divided it into about three different parts. Number one, we do emotional strength. In the emotional strength, we build their emotional strength to understand that, yes, what they have gone through, they cannot change it, but they can change the future that's ahead of them. They have gone through so much, but they can start all over again and be able to become successful in life. And we tell them that, you know, it's going to be a gradual process and you have to start now to achieve who you want to become in the future. Then the second part of the trauma therapy, we do forgiveness. Because we know that if these children cannot be able to forgive, if they can't reach the point of forgiving those who have hurt them and forgiving themselves, then they cannot get the emotional healing that we are looking for. And we know that once they don't forgive, they hold the bitterness inside them and that can destroy them physically. They will develop physical complications and they will be able to carry, they can carry this forward and hurt other people. So we really emphasize on forgiveness and we tell them it's going to be gradual. The third aspect is we do mentorship. We do what we call leadership mentorship. Our theme is raising peace ambassadors. Because to us, who can become a better peace advocate than the person who has gone through unthinkable pain? And he knows that if we didn't have this war, we would have lived maybe a much better life than this. And you know, when you sit with them in our sessions and we ask them, whom do you want to become? They will tell you, I want to become a member of parliament. I want to be able to have policies, functional policies that protect children. I don't want another child to go through what I have gone through. To us, that is so much. So we know that we are mentoring young people who are going to become leaders, not only in Northern Uganda, but that will affect the whole world in one way or the other. Some of them are going to be working with the UN in the near future. Some of them are going to be working maybe in some great radio stations like here, and they will be able to talk to people, the value of peace. They will be able to tell people that, yes, we have differences in our ideologies, but you know what? We can sit down and resolve this issue. We don't need the gun. The gun has torn us down. We can still go back to the old times when we sit down and solve issues on a round table. So we see that so much in these children. The second project that we do is education scholarships. Because we know without an education, it's almost next to impossible to realize an involvement in the life of an individual and then in the general community. And then most of these children, you find maybe a child was a former child soldier, is also an orphan. So if somebody does not step into their lives to support them go to school, then what becomes of them? They would keep thinking, if my father was there, if my mother was there, I would have also gone to school. And yet I know all of us, if we came together, just the little contribution from each one of us will make these children go to school and tomorrow they will become very responsible adults somewhere. Then we have water. We're trying to partner with some organizations like Dativa Water. It's an American-based organization that does water filters. And these water filters, definitely we give out to households, especially where these children come from. The children that we work with, the youth that we work with, you might find in a household, there's this little girl called Dilis. Dilis was abducted at the age of 8. That same night, her father was killed by the rebels. The mother was killed. They were abducted all together, and then she lost also two brothers to the LRA. She ended up getting abducted. She stayed in captivity and managed to escape. And when she comes back home, there are three little siblings she has to take care of. Today, she's 15 years old, but she's taking care of her three little siblings. They are just alone in their home. She's the head of the household. So if we're not going to step in the life of such children, what becomes of them? We give them this water filter. That means safe and clean water, which is very, very vital for their health. And a water filter costs $60. And you're giving clean water to this family for the next 7 to 10 years for $60. You really see the results. They talk about it, how it has helped them. The children are no longer falling sick from worms and all this. The fourth one is we're looking at socioeconomic empowerment. Because we have these child mothers who have returned from captivity with the children. A girl is abducted at the age of 8 years. She's in captivity for 10 years or more. She has come back with 4 children born in captivity. She has not been empowered through education because she lost all the childhood, and she's here to take care of 4 children.
She's alone.
And she's alone.
Has no partner.
Uh-huh. And then, of course, they also still have, there's so much stigma attached to this, coming back with these children, because the community is not accepting them yet fully.
The children or the...
The children.
The young women.
The children that the young girls have come back with, because they feel these are children to these rebel commanders who have made us suffer so much. This is a child to Kony, because I work with girls who were given out as sex slaves to Joseph Kony himself, and they have children with him, very little nice children, and I love all of them, each one of them.
And these young girls must love their children.
Yeah. And some of them honestly don't accept the children, but we teach them to love the children. How do we do this? We tell them that no single human being on this planet chooses a parent. I did not choose my mother. I didn't choose my father. Neither did you, neither did anyone on this planet. This is something that you wake up one morning and you know that's your father and that's your mother and that is it. We can't change this. And that's exactly what has happened to these children. Whether the biological father is Joseph Kony, whether he's a prominent person in America or in Uganda, they are children. They are very nice children like any other child. They are human beings like any other person. So we are not going to stigmatize somebody because of his parents, background, or anything. We are looking at children. They are all children, just like any child in your house, any child in your school. That is it. So we teach them slowly. And that's exactly what we are beginning to do. Our next step is have maybe some funds where we can do a radio program locally to be able to talk to the community. We want them to understand under what circumstances were these children born.
So Jen Akayu, you have become a counselor and taken this on yourself. What led you to build this project?
I have a training as a teacher. I was born and raised in Uganda. I also trained in gender and development. I did a lot of training, short trainings on trauma management. I also did a degree in democracy and development. And then right now I'm doing another course.
And this was all in Uganda?
All in Uganda. What has also helped is directly working with these children as they return. You get the experience, like each day you learn something different as you work with this child. We try to employ different methods in working with them, and some of them don't work. And then another one is working for this child. And each time, like, you know, you are learning something as you work with them. So the experience itself in working with them has taught me so much and has humbled me so much.
Thank you very much, Jane Akayu, both for your work and for coming here to talk with us and share it with us and our listeners.
Well, thank you so much.
When we come back, long-term effects of bullying on individuals, groups, and societies. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Bullies and victims of bullies are much more likely to develop psychological disorders such as agoraphobia, panic disorder, suicidal thoughts, and aggressive behavior as adults, according to a recent study. In both adult and adolescent settings, bullying cultures can emerge when bystanders and others disengage and allow the behavior to continue, ultimately creating abusive organizations. What is the long-term effect on individuals and, by extension, on societies resulting from bullying behaviors? Three experts join us. Catherine Bradshaw is a professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and School of Education. She is the deputy director of the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence and the co-director of the Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. Her studies include bullies, gangs, drugs, and school, understanding the overlap and the role of ethnicity and urbanicity, risk factors for bullying among children with autism and spectrum disorder, and teachers and education support professionals' perspectives on bullying and prevention. Yana Yuvonen is a professor of developmental psychology at UCLA. She is the author of Peer Harassment in School, The Plight of the Vulnerable and Victimized, and The Rejected and the Bullied, Lessons About Social Misfits from Developmental Psychology. Joyce Heems is chair and professor in the Department of Management and Industrial Relations at West Virginia University. Her publications include A Bully as an Archetypal Destructive Leader and Bullying from the Playground to the Boardroom. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. What I'd like to start with is long-term effects that bullying has on individuals who might have been either bullied when they were younger or even maybe older, and maybe even the bullies themselves. Catherine Bradshaw, let's start with you. You've said it has a profound effect on mental health all the way into adulthood. What are the effects on individuals and maybe by extension societies?
Well, the research on bullying is relatively recent when it comes to long-term effects. There has been a lot of cross-sectional research documenting immediate impacts and kind of correlates, as we would often think of them, of bullying, and trying to understand what longer-term impacts there are has really only been a more recent development as our longitudinal data systems have become more available to track long-term impacts. But we have seen a range of mental health impacts, including internalizing problems, externalizing problems like aggression, even substance use problems. When you think about the school environment, there are also concerns as it relates to academic performance, school attendance, and academic engagement more broadly.
You have also written a bit about, using these longitudinal studies, how youth who have either been bullied or bullies themselves become perhaps later in life more aggressive, delinquent, and maybe even members of gangs. What have you found?
Yes, we're actually seeing a lot of overlap in some cases of the youth that are involved in bullying as both a victim and a perpetrator. Youth that are aggressive and involved in bullying as a victim as well as a perpetrator often struggle with issues around emotion regulation, challenges calming down when they're upset, really trying to understand how they can interact in a way to resolve conflict in a peaceful way.
Yana Yuvonen, let's bring you in. What are the findings that you have seen?
Well, one of the interesting issues to me as we're learning about these long-term effects is the question of why. Why do kids engage in bullying and why is it so incredibly detrimental? One way to think about these issues of why is that bullying may at times serve a function. So rather than thinking about there are mean kids and then there are their poor targets, maybe in part bullying reflects circumstances or situations. There's some evidence suggesting that bullying peaks, especially during transitional periods of time when, for example, kids are transitioning from elementary schools to middle schools. And what we're curious about is how much this sort of bullying that may be in part temporary rather than stable is a reflection of the need to create a status hierarchy that may serve a purpose during a time of transition where kids are not necessarily aligned with their friends yet, when they need to sort of create a structure of their own. So bullying may serve a function during certain times, and when it serves this function, it may be particularly difficult to intervene with because these bullies, as they strive to be dominant individuals in the status hierarchy, they get rewarded by the peers. That is, nobody challenges them. Nobody dares to challenge them because they are so powerful.
Joyce Heems, you've looked at it from organizational perspectives, but I thought maybe what we should do is look first at the psychology. You've talked about the natural target that victims tend to be. What is that natural target?
Well, there is some evidence to say that if someone tends to be shy, reserved, withdrawn in day-to-day, that they may be more of a natural target for bullying. And we have looked at this. In fact, we had an article that said from the playground to the boardroom, and that we were seeing that some degree of evidence that those who were bullies as a child would take that aggressive behavior into the workplace, and that as things are changing, as organizations are changing, increased in change. I know Ivana just said that, you know, there's more changes are coming at people, and especially at the adult level, that they don't know how to handle that. They don't know how to handle that aggression, and maybe they have some resistance to authority. And as things are changing in environments in which they are not comfortable in, they act out in such a way. And they look for those that will not speak up to them, will not stand up. One of the studies that we're looking at now is what we call the worker-to-worker transaction. So not just the abusive supervisor or that power differential between the employee and the supervisor, but if I see someone bullying you and we're all colleagues, why or when would I want to step in? And what we're seeing is people say, I'm not even going to step in as an observer of that because I'm afraid that bully will turn on me. And the victim doesn't want to report the bully because afraid the bully will get even more aggressive. So our culture is not set up in such a way. Companies are just now coming on board. As Catherine said, we don't have longitudinal studies yet that really shares what the long-term effects are going to be. But companies are finally getting on board to say, we're going to have a zero tolerance, and we want a respectful, healthy environment is how they're phrasing this, and really trying to stay away from the terminology of bullying.
We've got a lot of mental disorders in this particular society in the U.S. Catherine Bradshaw, is there a relationship here?
We have documented through both short-term as well as long-term research that one's involvement in bullying is a risk factor for subsequent and concurrent behavioral and mental health concerns. And it's most pronounced among the youth that are involved as both a target as well as a perpetrator. While it is difficult, however, to tease out the cause versus the consequence, because often youth who are targeted might have internalizing problems, as the previous speaker referenced, or have other problems getting along well with others, and thus are marginalized either in the workplace or in the school environment. So this is really a complex phenomenon and often doesn't have very easy solutions. But if we think from a life course perspective that in childhood kids that are exposed to violence in the home or have challenges in their peer group and adopt an aggressive way of interacting with others or are reinforced, because sometimes that works, and that they might reach a higher dominance within their peer network, we can understand, and Yana commented on this, that sometimes that becomes adaptive for some kids. They can get rewarded. And we can very easily see similar extrapolations into the workplace as adults. Individuals that kind of bully others often are hoarding a lot of the resources and the power and the dominance within the work environment. And so that's why it's so important for us to keep in mind that these bullying activities, while we might be a little more comfortable calling them bullying among school-aged youth, and much of the research has taken that approach, there has been increasing interest in what does this really look like in the workplace, and what does this look like in college students or within adult populations. And we really have not seen very much research focused specifically at these issues in adulthood, and which youth continue on and which forms of aggression. For example, people often stereotypically think about bullying as just being physical, when we know the vast majority of bullying acts are more relational in nature and social in nature. And it's my hypothesis that those are really the ones that continue across the life course, and that they can get played out in terms of workplace drama or emails and text messages that are carried on in the workplace for adults. So I think it's really important for us to keep in mind a life course perspective, that these behaviors don't just go away.
Absolutely. If I may pitch in, this is Jana. So I think that it's fascinating the way Joyce talks about the workplace bullying, because really, in the end, it's not only about individuals, those who try to dominate and those who are the easy or safe targets, but it's also about the atmosphere, about the climate. Mm-hmm. Catherine has done work, and we've done some work on how bullying affects the entire climate of a school. So obviously, when we're talking about bullying, one of its most detrimental effects, besides it having long-term consequences for both bullies and victims, is that it really affects the well-being of everyone in that setting. And we have some evidence based on just these kind of daily reports that we do with students in school that even just witnessing somebody else getting bullied elevates their levels of anxiety during that day. So we're talking about pervasive effects on a large number of individuals in the setting where bullying takes place.
Let's then go to this idea of a bullying culture. All of you have touched on this a little bit. And Jana, I think in one of your pieces you talked about how popular and dominant bullies control the peer norms. Joyce Heems, I think that this is something that you've also written about in the more organizational and workplace settings. I'm a political scientist, so I, of course, wonder about how this gets carried on into the political settings like Congress, where we see some of this going on now. But when you have bullies as popular cultural leaders and political leaders, what happens to the societies? Joyce, you should start us on that.
Sure, absolutely. First, let me say that I would like to clarify, and we talked about this briefly, and I believe Catherine alluded to this, there is a distinction between what we would determine is workplace bullying and harassment or some other forms of aggressive behavior. And workplace bullying typically is more psychological than it is physical. It is more covert than it is overt. And the motivation behind it is not a prejudice or a bias typically. In fact, we found that bullying doesn't have a lot of biases. It's more about something you have that I want. So there's a greed or a jealousy or something along those lines. So I think that's a nice distinction to make in terms of what we're really talking about. But in one of the pieces that we did, more to your point, Maria, is that we talked about the social-emotional contagion theory and how that in the workplace people will often, if you will, catch the emotions and behaviors of other people. So if, for instance, I'm in an environment and cursing is allowed, and it goes on and on and on, I get immune to it after a while. And I may say things that historically I might not have said otherwise. So our environments are very key to this. So if bullying is allowed or is not corrected, is not countered in some way, those around will say, hey, you know, Catherine got away with that, so I bet I can. And they'll take on those types of behaviors. And I think that that cultural issue is really prevalent in this conversation, because organizations have got to take on more directive action in controlling this and putting in the zero tolerance type of policies.
And if they're coming from the leadership itself, then that becomes a complicating factor, I would think.
Ben Tepper and a few of his colleagues, Ben's down at Georgia State, has done a lot about the abusive supervisor and how to control those and putting in mechanisms back in the 80s and 90s when we were talking about sexual harassment and training and raising that awareness, putting in mechanisms so people could feel comfortable in reporting. And they haven't done that yet, I think, society-wide or organizational across industries for people to report bullying. So it's not just my peer that's bullying me, but it's my boss. How can I go around that? And we've got to put in mechanisms very much like we did to counter the sexual harassment that we saw so prevalent back in the 80s and 90s.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, and we're talking about the effects of bullying behavior on individuals, groups, organizations, and societies. Catherine Bradshaw.
Yeah, I think your use of the term zero tolerance is one thing that's gotten a lot of attention and some concern in the literature, and most of that has started off looking in juvenile justice settings and adult criminal offenses, and then has been somewhat extrapolated into the school setting and saying, well, we're going to take a zero tolerance type of approach around school bullying. And what that typically means is anybody that's bullying gets an automatic suspension and sent out. And we've seen other examples of this, of really harsh types of punitive responses to bullying, and frankly, we've learned that that kind of zero tolerance in a more formal policy type of way is one that we don't see a lot of evidence actually working. But I think Joyce is kind of alluding to a more colloquial term of, we're not going to accept this, this isn't tolerable, not that somebody's immediately going to get fired or punished as a result of that. So I think we need to have these environments where people don't feel a threat of turning in someone else, or and understanding the difference between reporting and tattling, as I often hear with kids, is I don't want to be a snitch, I don't want to be the one that kind of outed that person. And so I think as we try to take some of these concepts in the K to grade 12 type of setting and think, well, what would they really look like in the workplace? And are there certain policies and procedures that we would use in one context versus the other? So just want to put that kind of caveat around the zero tolerance type of approach, and what does that really mean from a policy standpoint in the school setting relative to a workplace.
Jana Juvonen.
I think it's interesting to think about the social contagion perspective that Joyce brought up, that indeed we know also in classrooms and in school settings, once there is a kid who gets by and becomes even more popular by bullying other kids, that encourages other kids to engage in bullying as well. But in addition to that, you know, going back to the sort of how bullying affects the entire climate of a setting or a collective, is that often bullying is perceived, although it may be anxiety-provoking, people fear and are concerned about becoming the next targets. At the same time, what they actually do behaviorally looks like they enjoy it. They enjoy watching it. That is, bullying often in school settings can be entertaining or amusing. So when the bystanders react that way, even when deep inside they say, oh my gosh, this is not really okay, or I sure hope I'm not going to be the next target, when they laugh, when they smile, they are encouraging bullying. So we get into these kind of vicious cycles, and this is precisely what's so very difficult to try to stop, is that in spite of the sense of unsafety, anxiety, etc., the way we behaviorally convey our attitudes about bullying, they seem to be very encouraging of the bully and bullying behavior. So that's yet another way in which bullying becomes socially contagious.
Social psychologists have frequently talked about why bystanders behave in particular ways, role-playing or the mob kinds of behaviors or groupthink. If, in fact, people naturally shy away from being the one to call it out, is there some way of approaching this to stop the mob? How does this interplay with this issue of bystanders?
This is Joyce. And one of the things that we talked about and are looking at right now is their ability to intervene. And our research is showing that they don't feel comfortable. They don't. Their self-efficacy of their success in that is very low. So they're saying, you know, I don't know how, I don't know whether I'd be effective. Would I make it worse for that person? Would I make it worse for me? You know, I was struck a couple years ago, my son-in-law is an orthopedic surgeon, and he was talking about this lady that had a major accident, and I made the comment, I said, oh my goodness, she'll never walk again. He said, no. He said, I can do this, I can fix that, I can mend this, and 6 months I'll have her up and walking. And I thought, you know, his ability, his knowledge of how to fix that situation, his self-efficacy was out the roof, his confidence level in that particular task. We don't have that when we're talking about the emotional, psychological impact, and especially of something so severe as what we're terming here as bullying. It takes someone who really has, even with social identity, we looked at if I think a fellow female is being bullied, would I tend to step in quicker? And yes, the research is showing that we would if we identify with that person in some way, because we don't want them to be bullied. So I would step in quicker if it was a female than if it was a man. If it's a child, absolutely. Everyone tends to want to run to the rescue of a child. But their thought process is, if I step in, can I make it better? Will I make it worse for them and for me? So it's hard for them to know how. We did some experimental studies and looked at training, and it was very little increase in their willingness to step in, even though they had some degree of training in how to do that. Again, that takes a lot, and this takes a psychologist or someone who really would feel comfortable doing that.
Is there a pathology that develops? For example, do bullies become authoritarian personalities? Do they become antisocial? Given the degree of people behind bars now, is there a relationship that you think has developed from this? Catherine, I think this is something that you started to talk about.
At a basic level, we know that an early onset of aggressive and pretty serious disruptive behavior problems can be a risk factor for what is often referred to as a life course persistent pattern of aggressive behavior. There have been researchers that have been looking at this both within the U.S. and internationally to try to understand some of those early precursors of aggressive behavior across the life course. And some of those include executive functioning problems, so kids' brains just operate a little bit differently than others, have problems with impulse control, emotion regulation. And so while those studies have been focused more generally on the issue of aggressive behavior, trying to understand some of these long-term outcomes, bullying could be one of those behaviors, but it's very difficult to look at a broader set of aggressive behaviors and say, well, does this generalize to every kid that bullies or to every kid that's aggressive? Because we know some kids, have a transition problem and thus they're vulnerable to experiencing difficulties and challenges, but through intervention they're able to get back on the right track or just kind of grow out of it, or in a peer context it's more supportive for one type of behavior over the other. So I think there is potential for aggressive behavior that has an early onset and is not intervened with effectively to lead to a more serious pattern of aggressive and problem behavior, and could lead to criminal activity as well as more serious psychopathology in adulthood. We see that tends to be highest among youth that are involved in bullying as both a target and as a perpetrator. And for example, one of our recent studies had shown that youth that were involved in bullying on both ends were much more likely to carry weapons and more likely to enter gangs. And so even taking gang activity as an example, I actually see some parallels between bullying and gang activity. For example, the power and status associated with aggression and aggressive behavior, dominance over others. Quite often there's a fear that you're going to be targeted by the gang if you don't become a member of the gang, and it's a very aggressive network and complex network around power that's drawing them together. So I see some similarities there on some basic levels. However, we have to be very, very cautious not to assume that every kid that engages in aggressive or bullying behavior is going to get on this life course persistent pathway, because there are some youth that engage in these behaviors and kind of trying them on, and they don't work out very well for them. They don't meet their need, be they social or instrumental, and perhaps also through effective intervention, we're able to get them off of that path. So frankly, the fact that we have, let's say 18 to 20% of youth have been the victim of bullying, we don't have those extremely high rates of adult psychopathology. But if they're not addressed, it can cause problems in their adult relationships, their relationships with their significant others, or even be passed on to their children. So we have to be cautious. In fact, I gave a talk on bullying at a psychiatric hospital in upstate New York, and afterwards one of the physicians came up to me and said, I feel like you're pathologizing the issue of bullying. We have to remember that there are a lot of kids that find themselves in a situation either because other peers are doing it through this peer contagion process that was discussed, but they engage in that behavior. And if it's addressed early on and effectively, I think it can really pull them off of that more negative trajectory.
Pertaining to globalization, and Joyce Heems, this is something you wrote about, how globalization might be enhancing, for lack of a better word, a bullying culture. Can you describe what you mean by this?
Well, we're talking about the rapid rate of change and the complexity of the organizations as they're going global, and as you're putting more diverse people together and them trying to understand and their comfort level with that. I'd also like to take that and talk a little bit about what Catherine was talking about and recognize that both the bully and victims, as we see them, and just anyone in general, has different coping mechanisms and different abilities to cope. So a young person who was exposed to bullying, maybe even tried it on, realized it didn't fit, and their coping mechanisms are strong enough that they break the bonds from that. By the same token, you may have a victim that has very low self-esteem, and their ability, they turn something that is really not bullying, and in their mind it becomes bullying because they don't have sufficient coping mechanisms in place. And that may have come from the fact they had been exposed to it as a child or some others, so they just don't know how to respond to it. So when we talk about globalization, we're talking about different cultures, different ways of responding, different ways of coping, and having to, as managers, having to interpret those different societal issues that people are coming from. So it just creates a whole level of complexity by adding this globalization to the workplace.
Jana Juvonen?
Well, let me very quickly on the issue of globalization. You know, that's a little harder to put it in the sort of world of school. But one issue, since Joyce mentioned, has to do with diversity that we're very intrigued about. We've been in Los Angeles studying the role of ethnic diversity. On one hand, you may think that when there's a lot of ethnic diversity in a school, you're going to get even more bullying that may be in part motivated by some sort of bias or self-preservation. But at the same time, what we are actually finding is that diversity can be protective. That is, when we find these really diverse, ethnically diverse schools where there's no one dominant ethnic group, but multiple groups about equal in size or relatively so, we get students reporting that they feel safer and they feel less bullied. And I think that's one of the ways in which we have to start doing this research is to find out more about these protective factors. In terms of social risk factors, I mean, other protective factors that decrease the risk factors for bullying is a presence of a friend. So we have to learn a little bit more about what makes a difference, what enables the bully or a victim cope better. And we know that when they feel socially supported, when their social dominance needs or their sense of vulnerability are met with somebody in the setting, everybody's better off.
That's a perfect place to end. Thank you to the three of you, Catherine Bradshaw, Jana Juvonen, and Joyce Heems. Catherine Bradshaw is a professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and School of Education. She is the deputy director of the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence and the co-director of the Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. Her studies include bullies, gangs, drugs, and school, understanding the overlap and the role of ethnicity and urbanicity, risk factors for bullying among children with autism and spectrum disorder, and teachers and education support professionals' perspectives on bullying and prevention. Jana Juvonen is a professor of developmental psychology at UCLA. She is the author of Peer Harassment in School, The Plight of the Vulnerable and Victimized, and The Rejected and the Bullied, Lessons About Social Misfits from Developmental Psychology. Joyce Heems is chair and professor in the Department of Management and Industrial Relations at West Virginia University. Her publications include A Bully as an Archetypal Destructive Leader and Bullying from the Playground to the Boardroom. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.